in the rap world, you know, you always don't want to have authority involved. You know, I know it shouldn't be that way, but it is how it is. Right? We don't. Rap is one of those genres that always speaks against authority in some way, shape, or form. Maybe not these days, but back in the day, it definitely was. So then I was looking at the career path for an electrical engineer and an electronic engineer. You basically have to study under somebody else. You know, you have to be an intern, you have to be an apprentice, whatever else. And then you can become a professional engineer who's certified by whatever body. And then on the flip side, with computer science, you have a laptop and you have an internet connection. Oh, you could build whatever it is you want to build, right? And that, for me, felt much more closer to the culture that I was accustomed to with regards to Bitcoin, with regards to rap, right? And okay, then I think you can extrapolate as to why I found Bitcoin very attractive, because, you know, it's like the same culture. Whose permission do you need? Nobody's permission.
Mic check 1-2, do the step 1-2. We carving through like a baby's tooth. Long overdue, that's the worst of proofs. Been hurt by few, but won't hurt to put this piece to use. This is for you, this piece is proof that one's fate improves. When make it moves, we'll make it through. This is the cue.
What is up, everybody? Welcome back. Today we have a super special guest, Kagatso Ngako, most people refer to him as KG, a perfect person to have on this podcast as he is a true Renaissance man. So I'm going to give a quick sort of introduction about what I know about him and what he's working on, and then hand the mic over to him to sort of fill in any gaps of what I missed. So KG was born and raised in Mamelodi, a township in Pretoria, South Africa. He's most well known for inventing Machankura. Machankura is slang for money. This is a custodial Bitcoin Lightning Network service. Basically, on a layer 2 on Bitcoin, you're permitted now to send Bitcoin or to perform Bitcoin transactions without an internet connection. And this happens over the USSD network via feature phones, like those old sort of Nokia phones. So essentially this allows you to transact with Bitcoin without even needing a smartphone, which is pretty incredible. Most of you listening to this probably know that already, but I just wanted to let people who, are not familiar with, KG's work to understand that. He also works on, and I hope I'm pronouncing this correctly, Exonumia, a nonprofit, that does open source translations for Bitcoin literature to help with, educational, work. I think that they're currently in the process of translating the Bitcoin standard into Swahili. He's also an organizer for Adopting Bitcoin Cape Town, a conference focused on Bitcoin adoption in communities, and with, again, another focus on the Lightning Network and how it's being used in these communities. So we're going to dive into these projects today, but I also want to sort of preface this before we get started with KG. You know, beyond being an amazing technical mind, computer scientist, he's also a musician and a highly creative person in general. And I'd like to learn more about where he gets some of his inspiration today. And one last thing, it just came out today, and we did not schedule this so that it happened in tandem, but the African Bitcoin Bitcoiners Committee awarded KG the number one African Bitcoiner of the Year award. This is quite an honor. He was in the company of some absolutely incredible people, so to be number one is a very cool thing. So let me stop rambling there. Please tell us a little bit about yourself and tell us a little bit about how it feels to be, you know, given this award from this committee.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, where do I start then? Well, yeah, maybe let me just start with the award. It feels great first and foremost. And yeah, you know, there's really quite a lot of interesting people on that list, people who are doing very magnificent work. And even some people who are still not on that list that are still, you know, doing magnificent work. So yeah, I hope we all get to learn a bit about them moving forward. And, you know, you're already doing a good job of featuring quite a few of those people on your podcast. So, yeah, I really hope you continue doing that. And, yeah, so that being said, I'd just like to see Bitcoin being used across the African continent, right? And what I want to do is effectively accelerate that adoption. And yeah, so pretty much everything I'm doing is towards accelerating the adoption of Bitcoin across the African continent. And yeah, cool. Then what else outside of that should we dabble in?
We will get to talking about how to hopefully facilitate greater Bitcoin adoption across the African continent, which I think is really important to talk about the nuance of, especially having just been there. A lot of people like to talk about Bitcoin in Africa and this and that, but seeing it on the ground there, it's going to be, I think there's a lot of work to be done to actually get people to understand it a bit better, to actually adopt it, to use it, all that. But we'll get to that in a second. What I wanted to get to was, you know, I don't, if anyone listening to this has seen KG speak before, you probably understand what I'm saying, but I just saw him speak for the first time in Ghana. And, you know, he's one of the few people, I think, in the world that can go from citing Ludwig von Mises, one of the sort of major names in the Austrian economic school of thought, and a few slides later sort of, you know, tying that into some reference to Kendrick Lamar or Tupac. So there's a lot of sort of creativity and creative inspiration infused in what you do with Machankura. So I was just sort of wondering, and you mentioned to me when we spoke in Ghana that you've went from recording your own music, working as, you know, or, you know, putting out your own mixtape and all of this, to now putting your creative efforts into Machankura. So I just wanted to know what that creative process is like when you create things like Machankura and you're expanding on what you're doing with Machankura. Do you approach that in a similar way that you used to kind of approach making music or other creative endeavors?
Yeah. So, yeah, I think let me then start in primary school. Right. So, I had a very old PC. I think it was in grade 5, and my mother brought it home, and then it was just sitting there. And then on this other day, my brother came through with a friend of his, and then they installed Fruity Loop on the machine. Right. So, yeah, so I then started playing around with it, trying to figure out what to do. I didn't really know what I was doing, but for a kid who's just experiencing this thing for the first time, I would press a button and then sound would come out. So it felt and seemed fun. And yeah, as the years progressed, I then started making beats. So the thing with me is I don't know how to play music, musical notes or a keyboard or anything, but the beauty with Fruity Loops is if you spend enough time on it, you can make a song, right? As long as you know what sounds good, you could use the piano roll and do whatever else, watch a YouTube video to learn how to mix whatever else. But that being said, at the time that I was doing this, YouTube was not a thing, so I literally had to spend a lot of time figuring things out. And yeah, so that is how my journey as a creative kind of started. And then after that, basically my brother was a rapper, so when I was like 14, he would be playing rap music very loud on the sound system. This was back when sound systems were made to be loud. None of these what do they call it, sound pills that you put in front of the TV, because the TV sound system is bad since the screen is so flat, they cannot put good speakers in the TV anymore. So, a soundbar. None of the soundbars. So, if you had a sound system in your house, it could actually make some noise. So, yeah, my brother would be playing rap music very loudly. And I think on one of the days he was playing music, I asked him, like, yo, could you turn it down a bit? Because, you know, it's quite loud. And he said, if you battle me, I'll turn it down. Right. So next day at school, I was writing battle bars just to get the sound system down. And that's how my journey as a rapper then began. Right. And so from there, 14, 15, 16, I'm rapping, DJing, putting together local shows, whatever else needed to happen, I'll be doing it. And learning a little bit about the music industry too, right? We would go to these music seminars. My brothers were effectively independent artists, right? And I learned quite a lot about the music industry as an independent artist. I learned quite a lot about how the contracts work, learned quite a lot about how needle time works, all of that stuff, right? Publishing, so on and so forth, right? But then I got to graduating high school, which is matric in our case. So I had to make a decision whether I continue down that track of rap and music and whatever else we were doing, or do something else, right? And that something would have been study computer science at the University of Pretoria. So in my mind, technically, I've seen my brothers do this for the past 4 years. None of them are able to do it full time. They're still working jobs to, you know, put food on the table. But then, yeah, they do this thing on weekends or whenever they have an off day. So I'm like, okay, maybe that's not the best path to take. So I took computer science, and then pretty much why I'm here. I became a programmer, so on and so forth. But that being said, I really feel like, okay, but maybe that's a topic for another day. I still had creative energy even through a university, so I had to find an outlet, and poetry became that outlet. Right? Mm. So I would write poems and join the poetry circles. And yeah, so one of the huge differences between the poetry audience and the rap audience is that the poetry audience listens to pretty much every word you're saying, right? So I could spend more time putting words on a piece of paper. And also, there's nothing behind the words. There's no music behind the words. Yes, you can perform with music, but they are getting exactly what you're performing in the exact way you want it to be received. Maybe it is perceived differently than you want, but that's besides the point. And yeah, so I spent more time there, and you know, I wanted to see how far a person could take it with a pen, because we have a lot of talented poets in South Africa. Kolega Putuma, Tabiso Vili, Masai Sapura, Mudise Sekgato, the list goes on and on. And all these guys are really pushing the needle with regards to creativity and what you can do with words on a page and words on a stage, like slam poetry. Tabiso Vili, I think he's a world champion slam poet, current world champion slam poet. And so, yeah, I was exploring that. But then I had to think about why and what were we doing in rap, and how rap is different now, right? So what we were doing in rap is we would have weekly cyphers, and then we would go to shows and perform songs. So we were technically always match fit, right? But we were not conscious of the fact that we were actually practicing at the cypher. Mm. Right? We were practicing a verse we were going to perform over the weekend at whatever event we were going to. And even at that event, if you had a 15-minute set, you could at least slot in a 2-minute song that you haven't performed yet, right? Mm-hmm. And then you would, you know, clean up your collection of music and decide, okay, these are the songs that I'm going to put out. Even the slam poets. Kolega Putuma is a slam poet who wrote pretty much the best-selling poetry book in South Africa called Collective Amnesia. Most of those poems you could test out in the slam poetry set. Right? Slam poetry, very evocative performance. Written poetry, you know, you can do more with written poetry because you don't have to always be energetic. You don't have to always be evocative. So, yeah, but then she knew what people would react to when she was writing the book. And yeah, so I was like, okay, there's something being in front of the stage, being in front of people gives you that you don't get otherwise, right? So yeah, I think that all of that informed how I would approach stuff. And yeah, technically took some of those processes and I applied them to music and to software development, right? So I would always try to find a concept in music and relate it to software. Many reasons why I believe you should do this. It also helps explaining it to other people when you are working with them, when you're collaborating, what it is you're trying to do. And I think one of the things I had mentioned to you in Ghana was that effectively, music has like a time signature, you know, a 4-4 time signature, which is the beat, the pace, and whatever else of the song, right? And when you're making an instrument or playing music, whatever note you're playing have to fit within the 4-4 time signature. It lets you know where the bar is going to be. It lets you know where the beat is going to be, how many beats in the song, how many bars in the song, so on and so forth. So, yeah. And for me, like, even when I was building the USSD interface, although be it at a much later stage when I was refining it a little more, it felt like whatever I was doing, since it, the interface is only text-based and the character limit is 160 characters, right? I was very limited in what I was going to do, and it felt like trying to put notes on a 4-4 time signature. And so there's certain things that the user can get used to, right? In the case of the USSD menu, is the list of options: 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4. So every screen that a person goes through in the USSD interface has that 1, 2, 3, 4 list. It's longer than 4. It could go up to 9, even more numbers if I wanted to. But then for it to be easy and very consumable, you have to keep to that, right? And then there's other screens where it's not a list, but it's an input where you're asking the user to input something, right? And as soon as the user sees that they are not given 1, 2, 3, 4, they should understand. And it's much easier for them to understand that, oh, now I'm supposed to input something other than 1, 2, 3, 4, right? Either an amount, either a username, either whatever else, so they read the message you have written for them, right? And that for me felt like, you know, in a song there's like a bridge section that you can do whatever. Like Kanye West had a song, "Do You Realize That You Are a Champion," that sampled, I think, Charlamagne or something like that. Let me look it up. But the shocking thing with the sample is that the Charlamagne song is an acoustic guitar for like majority of the song, right? But then when the part that Kanye sampled has an electronic type sound to it, electronic feel, oh, Kid Charlamagne by Steely Dan or something like this, a 1976 record, right? So yeah, music allows you to do all of these things where, yes, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, but then you just want to do something for like 2 seconds and then come back, right? 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4. And yeah, so that's the USSD interface for how we're approaching it. And thinking about it in that way also helps, because we can then do design, right? We can then say, okay, a person should be able to go back from a certain menu, right? So we can put the option to go back. Let's say 77 is the option to go back. But then we are still trying to work within that 160 character limit. So we cannot always put back on the every screen, because then it's like how many characters? 2 space and then 4. So that's like 6 or 7 characters that are being used up by just always having the back option on the screen. So you only show it on certain screens and then hope that the user at some point will say, oh, there's that back option that I once saw. Can I use it on this screen? Because now I do want to go back. And then when they input 77, they go back and they're like, ah, cool, it works. So that feels almost similar to, like, you know, there's always a hi-hat in the background of whatever genre of music you're listening to. And yeah, so even if you don't know that the hi-hat is there, the hi-hat is there. Majority of the time, yes, there are some songs that do not have a hi-hat, but the vast majority of music has hi-hats in the background. And since the hi-hats are always there, we don't hear them anymore. But if they're not there, we kind of notice, right? We kind of notice that they're not there. Same way that if a user tries to input 77 for back in the USSD interface and it doesn't go back, then the user's like, ah, okay, I hope this back option was on every screen, right? So, yeah, cool. So that is effectively Ming and the, you know, creative a journey and the creative energy and how I'm still trying to use creative software dev as a creative outlet, right? And that is the reason why I still am not writing any more poetry, still not making any more songs, because I feel like creative energy is a limited resource. You know, if you use it, you cannot reuse it. Yeah, it's depleted, so you have to find a way to replenish it.
Yeah, thank you. That was beautiful. I appreciate you sharing all that. The first thing, there's a billion different threads I could pull on there, but I guess my first thought was, given that your first the first thing you started with there when you got into creativity was, you know, this idea of Fruity Loop, so there was this intrinsic sort of mesh between technology and creativity from the second you started being creative, at least based on the story you just told. So was the fact that you were sort of inspired to get better at what you were doing creatively, and you had to sort of, like you said, without YouTube, sort of push the limits of what you were capable of technologically, was that the beginning of you becoming interested in working more with software?
Yes, but no, not necessarily. The reason why I got interested in working with software was Facebook. When I was in high school, I applied to actually study electrical engineering or electronic engineering at the University of Pretoria. And then they had career day at the University of the Mamelodi campus of the university. And then I went to the career day, and all faculties, kind of all modules, all courses had a table at the career day. This was the engineering career day. And so all the kids had ran to the electronic and electrical engineering table. Pretty much every other engineering table had a lot of people there. And then the computer science table was pretty much empty, except for the two nerds that were manning the station. So I had a conversation with them, and I was like, "Hey, what do you guys do?" And they were like, "Computer science." And I was asking, "Okay, what do computer scientists build?" And they said, "Facebook." And I was like, "Oh, damn, I use Facebook." So then does it mean if I study computer science, I could build a Facebook myself? And they said yes. And so I was like, okay, cool. The thing is, I had applied to study that thing over there. Am I able to switch that decision? And they said yes. So yeah, I then switched over to computer science from electronic engineering. And yeah, ever since, I was like, okay, cool. And that is effectively why I was doing software dev, right? And I also think it was also informed by in the rap world, you know, you always don't want to have authority involved. You know, I know it shouldn't be that way, but it is how it is, right? We don't, rap is one of those genres that, always speaks against authority in some way, shape, or form. Maybe not these days, but, back in the day, it definitely was. So then, I was looking at the career path for an electrical engineer and an electronic engineer. You basically have to study under somebody else. You know, you have to be an intern, you have to be an apprentice, whatever else, and then you can become a professional engineer who's certified by whatever body. And then on the flip side, with computer science, you have a laptop and you have a internet connection. oh, you could build whatever it is you want to build, right? And that, for me, felt much more closer to the culture that I was accustomed to with regards to Bitcoin, with regards to rap, right? And okay, then I think you can extrapolate as to why I found Bitcoin very attractive, because, yeah, you know, it's like the same culture. Whose permission do you need? Nobody's permission, right? So, yeah, and hopefully that answers your question.
Perfect. Yeah. I as I mentioned to you when we met in person, I related deeply to that. I used to be in the music business. We had a conversation about this in person, but I came at it a little bit more from like the punk rock and underground hardcore world. I was involved in that scene pre-internet in the 90s, and it was especially sort of, it's still permissionless in a way, but it was a lot of, you know, people, you know, DIY culture, do things yourself, don't ask permission. You're not waiting for a record label. You're not trying to do anything other than put out the most quality stuff out there that's going to resonate as deeply as possible with people. So I the night that somebody explained what Bitcoin was to me was middle of January, 2018. And there was no learning curve for me. I just went home immediately and went down the rabbit hole. When I understood the concept, it was like immediately it clicked in my brain. I was like, oh, I've seen this before in a subculture. And at that time, I would say Bitcoin, you know, we could still call it a subculture. It's obviously becoming a bit more of a mainstream thing. But, you know, back then it was even difficult to get money to like a Coinbase account. I had to wire transfer it. It wasn't, you know, it really wasn't that easy to trade or invest or anything like that. So it was a very quick learning curve for me. And I sort of had that, I looked at it through that sort of what I had experienced in music socioculturally, or that phenomenon that I was a part of in the 90s and early 2000s, to understand it better. And also understanding hip hop growing up in New York. I was around during the golden era of hip hop, 88 to 96. And a lot of what went on back then, it really wasn't a global phenomenon yet. Hip hop was a very local thing. And my father did a lot of work in neighborhoods, in African-American neighborhoods, doing community revitalization work. And so I experienced a lot of that culture firsthand, also like through cinema. A lot of the movies that came out were a lot of like everything from like White Men Can't Jump, all these movies that were sort of affiliated with hip hop culture. And then I would see people come into the theater with Wu-Tang shirts on and Notorious B.I.G. shirts on. And now we think about these names and they're just tremendous. They're huge sort of global names. But back then they weren't. There was a very underground sort of permissionless, dangerous thing. And it was cool. It was a really, really cool thing. So I felt that same vibe immediately with Bitcoin. I want to ask you actually another question I asked you in person. You inspired me to pick up my copy here of Human Action because of the effect that it had on mm-hmm. you. So I've been delving into it. I've already read the Bitcoin Standard, and I've read the work of other Austrian economists like Hayek. And I would say that some of what Bitcoin did, it amplified ways that I already thought about the world, as I just mentioned with music, the permissionless nature, wanting to be a part of cultures or subcultures like that. But it also brought new ideas to my mind, that, you know, new ways of viewing the world that I just hadn't experienced before, hadn't really encountered before. So I'm curious with you. So it seemed like a seamless transition to understand something like Bitcoin. But what has Bitcoin done to broaden your framework of the world? What has it actually done to sort of change your mind in a way, or alter your mind in a way?
So, you know, I think a lot of these books I wouldn't have read without Bitcoin being a thing, right? Like, even if you look at Human Action, like book from the 40s, 1940s, isn't something you would want to read for whatever reason. Even if it's prescribed in a module you're studying, you'd avoid it. So, I think Bitcoin has really presented me with reason to look at things myself, you know, like the whole do your own research bit. See even things that are not necessarily from the area that I may be an expert in, right? So like economics and everything else. And yeah, what I've learned is, for the most part, even most of the things that we are seeing in the world that are wrong with the world, usually by recommendation, right? Some of the worst things that could ever be possibly done was actually recommended. And whether this is from a health perspective, so on and so forth, even some genocide, you know, some genocides are really a recommendation from the people in authority. It's very hard to get a genocide without an authority figure in place to ensure that it happens, whether or not they want to take the credit for it, right? And this is for countries like Rwanda or, you know, well, in this case, Israel, depending on how you view it, right? And yeah, so Bitcoin for me is like, okay, cool. All of these things, all of these atrocities are happening in the world. Why? Why is the global health kind of going down the drain? Like, it's when people should be, you know, living healthier lives, since we've made so much progress with regards to what can be done in the world. And we still going the opposite way. Like I tell people my age that now, and I'm 30, by the way, now we should be taking our health more seriously, because on a regular basis, we hear about peers that die from heart attacks, right, when we are 30. And it's almost old age diseases, cancer, or whatever else used to be an old age disease is now affecting more and more of the younger population. So, yeah, and for me, Bitcoin has given me a reason to really go down that rabbit hole and look at things from an objective perspective and say, maybe some of these people are actually wrong. Maybe some of these experts are actually wrong. And yeah, and I think if you are able to then substantiate why they are wrong with regards, let's say, to a topic like money, why should money not be an inflationary currency? You are then able to substantiate so many other things, like why should people not be eating seed oils? Why should we be consuming less sugar? Right? So even Coke, like Coke has affected more people, or Coca-Cola, not cocaine, but Coca-Cola has affected more people's health than alcoholism. Right? And alcoholism has at least a support group if you want to go sober, if you want to go clean. But if you want to stop drinking Coca-Cola, you have to then go on that journey yourself and figure it out for yourself. And hopefully you are not already addicted at this point, and hopefully your health hasn't deteriorated to the point that it's bad. But yeah, one of the most interesting things I saw, like even around 2012-2015, was I was trying to just drink healthier stuff, right? And you get to a restaurant, you get to a store, the juice is more expensive than the Coca-Cola, right? The bottle of water is more expensive than the Coca-Cola. So the Coca-Cola, if you're buying a meal and it comes with a drink, usually a Coke or whatever other soda, is included in the price. But as soon as you swap it out for a bottle of water, bottle of juice, whatever else you may want to drink, they increase the amount. So this is, for me, one of those ways where you're like, why is it designed in this way? Shouldn't a bottle of water be cheaper than soda? And yeah, then you look at how, from an economic perspective, the recommendation is, of course, live within your means. But everything that's cheap to buy is bad for your health. Yes. Right? If your groceries are affordable, if you're living frugal, which is also yet another recommendation, if you want to be financially independent, you have to live frugally. And the things you can buy as a frugal person usually are bad for your health. So what do you do? Right? So yeah, the recommendations are usually bad. And so yeah, I feel like Bitcoin has allowed me to then look at things and say, okay, maybe that's not good. Maybe we should look at something else. Maybe we should try something else. So yeah.
It's had the same effect on me, and I think many other people who have really gone down the rabbit hole, as they say. I guess my thoughts there, the first thing that comes to mind is when you sort of talk about these things, when you sort of really look at the way things are currently set up on all different levels and start to reconsider them and then start to propose alternative ideas, people around you, some of them almost get angry because in some ways you're challenging their worldviews or what they've just accepted as a norm that they don't want disturbed. Other people will ignore you. They just don't want to be bothered with this. And then, you know, other people will sort of laugh it off like, I don't know, you're a conspiracy theorist or blah, 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 blah. So in going down this rabbit hole, you've now created something, people are using it and all that stuff. But I think inevitably it sort of has an effect on personal relationships. So people around you, has it, have people around you begun to look at you differently? Have some begin to, I don't, you know, everything from like question your sanity to just sort of think that you're always sort of overblowing things or thinking too much about things. Have you seen this effect at all or experienced this at all?
No, I don't think so. I think the opposite. I think people around me are kind of on the, oh, this guy is kind of right, train right now. Right. So, and I think the other thing is effectively how it happened with me is that I kind of quit my job in like 2021. Was it 20? Oh, no, 2020. Yes. Was it 2021? Man, I lost sense of time, but I think it's 2020. I quit my job at AWS. And yeah, in my books, I was like, oh, the pandemic is whatever the pandemic was, and it has really affected how companies run, right? And if you start anything now, you would get a head start over all these other companies because they are not focused on what they should be focused on. They are too busy looking at the remote work policies, vaccination policies, all of these different things that by the time that they start actually looking at what gives their company value, what keeps them profitable, it would have been like months later, maybe even years later. So if you're starting out, you have that time as a head start. And yeah, I came to that conclusion by looking at things like Zoom, by looking at things like Animal Farm, by looking at whatever else was popping during 2020, during the pandemic. I think Red Dead Redemption was also big. And I was like, okay, cool. So if you're going to start something in the digital space, this would be the best time to do it. And yeah, even, you know, from a family perspective, they're like, are you crazy? Why are you going to quit your job now in this whatever economy? Things are uncertain, so on and so forth. So yeah, 2020, 2021, 2022, 2023. So 3 years later, I'm still, you know, not back at the job. And actually last year, this time, I had told people that, yo, if I, in November 2022, I was like, if I make it past November 2022, then I'm never going back to corporate for whatever reasons I had. And yeah, so everyone around me kind of like, oh, okay, cool. So whatever decisions, whatever things informed me, they must be some, they must be grounded somewhere, right? So, now when I'm talking about Bitcoin and I'm like, hey, no, you should consider using Bitcoin for 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 different things. As I said as well earlier, I could substantiate why and they could then see, okay, cool, you may have a point here. Right. So yeah, I don't think it has gone the opposite way where people think crazy. But I would say so that some people that are still where I used to work are not, you know, are not getting why Bitcoin as of yet. But I understand, you know, comfort is a beautiful thing. And there's actually a song by Ian Kamau, which kind of explains that. It's called Sidewalks. And in it, he says, I walked out the front of a house I once called home to stand on the sidewalk in the rain. I'm forgetting the rest of it, but what he basically says is that he realized it was cold and lonely in the house, but not only in the house, but the whole neighborhood. And so he was walking around this neighborhood trying to see how people were living, and he was trying to make them aware of, you know, the situation that they were in, but they were, you know, trapped inside the comforts of their own house for them to even see that, yo, thing this is actually cold, and it would be warmer if you were in the rain. So yeah, to the people who are still at you know, working comfortable jobs and everything like that, that do not see where the world is going and do not see that they could actually steer things in a different direction, it is what it is. You know, it's comfort. They could live their life as they feel like.
Beautifully put. And in terms of the people like yourself who are involved in steering the world in a new direction, it's one thing for people to opt out and just not be involved, but also in this process of steering the world in a new direction, there are going to be people that have issues with it. So in the United States, we have the likes of Elizabeth Warren, people in government who will do any, they have their anti-crypto, anti-Bitcoin army, trying to stop what the rest of us basically understand is inevitable with Bitcoin, or at least believe is inevitable with Bitcoin. For yourself, you know, you're part of this sort of making Bitcoin inevitable, but also you have a company, you're challenging mobile money as it stands today. What sorts of hurdles do you feel like you're inevitably going to have to surmount when the incumbents basically say, like, no way, you're not, you know, maybe now you're sort of a fringe thing. You don't have that much of the market share, but as you sort of get bigger and bigger, there's going to be people who are going to want to stop you. How do you look at that, or how do you think about that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think Bitcoin presents us with an opportunity to build very robust systems, right? Due to, you know, decentralization, its distributed nature, so on and so forth. So I feel like if we get things right, whoever's opinion on the matter does not really register, right? And yeah, people can continue using it. And I feel like that is where we should get to quite soon. Like, even in South Africa during the pandemic, the president would say stuff like, yo, you shouldn't do this now, or you shouldn't wear a mask, you shouldn't do whatever. And then I was like, what is the relationship between me and the president? What if I just block the president's Twitter account, and so whatever message he's trying to send to me doesn't get to me, right? And yeah. Technically, I feel like every person should have a right to do that. But of course, they don't want you to do that, which is why they can send you emergency notifications on your cell phone, whether or not you have a setting disabled or whatever else. Right? So then I think the other thing is we should be very careful, because a lot of people, what's this? Opposed to whatever certain people say or whatever the authority says, right? Yeah. So a lot of people will embrace Bitcoin because your Elizabeth Warrens are against Bitcoin, since they are against whatever, you know, the authority says. Yep. But over time, what will become and what will happen is that the authority or the people who want to have control will say things in such a way that whether or not you are opposed to what they're saying, you will do what they want you to do. Right? So I have a friend in South Africa during the pandemic, smoking was illegal. Well, selling cigarettes was illegal. So technically smoking was illegal because you couldn't buy cigarettes, or you couldn't legally buy cigarettes. And this guy went out and developed a smoking habit during this time. So not only did he have to go out to buy cigarettes, but he had to go and buy cigarettes when nobody else could buy cigarettes. So he had to go, like, you know, around the corner, find the guy who knows the guy, and then buy some cigarettes and develop the smoking habit. So anyway, ultimately still, smoking is not good for your health, especially if you're smoking too much. So why, if you are opposed to certain things that the authority says, you may be doing yourself a disservice. So we need to learn how to actually, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? Develop and pick our own stances on certain topics and fully embrace and fully explore those decisions. Right. So with Bitcoin, it being decentralized, it being a decentralized alternative to money or to, and how Saifedean put it on the Bitcoin standard, a decentralized alternative to central banking. If that is the way you saw it, fully explore that and fully try to achieve that and ignore whatever everyone else is saying. Right. I feel this whole, a bill is proposed, hey, you should leave a comment and blah, blah, tell them you are not for this bill and they should blah, 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 remove it or fix it or whatever else is counterproductive, right? Because if they know that, then all they have to do to keep you preoccupied is keep proposing bad bills. And I feel like they could do this because that's what they've been doing. It's like every month there's a new bad bill being proposed. So, at what point do you get the time and spend the time on actually achieving the things that you want to achieve, right? Because all that needs to happen is for you to believe that what the most important thing for you to do with your time is actually opposing all of these proposed bills that are wrong, right? So once you start doing that, you're not developing, you're not onboarding new people, you're not doing so many things that you need to be doing. So then they win because you lose traction. I recently, well, not recently, but over the past year, I was looking at Nostra clients versus Twitter, right? Ultimately, Nostra should have won, but this year, I would try to say, all the Nostra clients lost to Twitter this year, right? Primarily because the Twitter client pushes features out more and quicker than any Nostra client, right? Maybe except for Amethyst, but then Amethyst doesn't really spend enough time on user-centric features. Mm. And, well, it spends too much time on whatever is the coolest feature. And when you open Amethyst, there's really so much happening there as a user. You're like, yeah, okay, cool. Let me, you know, just go to some other thing. So, anyone who can outchip you will win, right? So Bitcoin wins in most cases because it's on 24/7. Bitcoin is always on. It doesn't have a banking holiday. It doesn't do whatever. Even the value, what part of the reason the value is so high is all those extra days it was trading versus something else, versus a stock, it means that the price discovery can happen much quicker than it would have happened otherwise. So even if from a shipping perspective, if we could just ship more features on a regular basis and figure out what things users are struggling with, then we win. But if we are spending that time arguing, opposing proposed bills, that is an opportunity cost too high for us to afford. So yeah, that's how I feel on that topic.
That's, yeah, it's amazingly put. It's weird that you say that too. I used to be one of those people who's like, we need to oppose this bill, we need to do this. And it was just this last bill that she proposed. One, for the listeners who don't understand this, I think Elizabeth Warren has proposed something like 120 bills and one of them has passed. So just keep in mind that, you know, a lot of what she does is for show, and it's probably to have the exact effect that KG is talking about here, just to get people not focused on what they should be focusing on, but on focused on opposing her instead, creating some sort of drama around the situation. You talked about this importance of shipping. I wouldn't say you're not framing it like this, but you know, some might frame it as sort of a race against time. You want to get as much out there as possible in the shortest amount of time to make things as user-friendly as possible. And recently, I think you posted on Twitter, you said, you know, I really wish they would just approve the Ethereum ETF and just leave the Bitcoin one alone for a while so we could sort of do more work in the meantime before the price goes up or whatever. Could you expand a little bit on that?
Oh, yeah. So that tweet comes from another tweet I thought about, and I can't find that tweet, sadly. But it's a question of how do you stop Bitcoin, And the answer is you cannot. You cannot stop Bitcoin. Bitcoin is here unless something tragic happens to Luke, and then, you know, okay, cool. But I don't think that is happening anytime soon. So effectively, then what you can do is do something better. And I think this is a thought process that Saifedean went down with regards to how do you stop hyper-Bitcoinization. Well, as long as inflation is low, you know, people, most people don't have a reason to consider Bitcoin because inflation is low. Even though the Bitcoin price will regularly go up, most people are still frogs that are being boiled slowly, so they don't see a problem. Right. But when inflation is high, then, you know, a lot of people are aware of whatever the problem is. Like in Canada, I have a hashtag, well, not a hashtag, a recurring tweet where I say, it's the economic heat death of the heat death of the economy, right? Or the heat death of an inflationary monetary policy, right? Whenever people are posting how they cannot afford groceries anymore, so on and so forth, the inflation became so high that they are not being paid enough to afford the same lifestyles that they used to live 2-5 years ago, right? Yep. So yeah, and I like the heat death analogy because the universe is expanding and it requires energy to expand, right? It's not just expanding. So as soon as there's no more energy for it to expand, it's a heat death, so it stops expanding. But still, it's death for real. So and I feel an inflationary monetary currency or policy has the same characteristics because it's also running on the idea of expansion. So, but that expansion also requires energy, requires debasement for it to happen. So if there is no one to debase left, then the inflationary monetary policy fails, and it fails dismally. So cool. Back to the original question. I really went down that path and I forgot where I was going for this. What was the original question? My bad.
No, I said, you know, it was a great point. And it's something that I actually feel too. It's that I don't really want the ETF approved, the Bitcoin ETF. You said, oh, just approve the Ethereum one.
Oh, and, yeah, yeah. Ethereum ETF. Oh, cool. Now I remember. So, yeah, so I feel then if like your Elizabeth Warrens or whoever else really want to stop Bitcoin, they should make a workable alternative, right? So what happens if they approve the Ethereum ETF before the Bitcoin ETF is that all these institutional investors that people are talking about really don't know the difference between Bitcoin and Ethereum. To them, it's a 6 and a 9, right? So they will put however much money as they feel like putting, and most probably to the extent where the Ethereum market cap for the first time ever is higher than the Bitcoin market cap. And so a lot of people, I don't think, are ready to have that conversation. Like, how do you talk about Bitcoin on the day that Ethereum's market cap is higher than Bitcoin's market cap, right? Okay. Which is possible, like, in the event that, from what people are speculating on, in the event that the Ethereum ETF is approved before the Bitcoin ETF, then we are not able to say Bitcoin is the number one market cap coin anymore, right? We will need to be able to reason and substantiate very well on why a person should use Bitcoin over Ethereum, right? And yes, I feel like a lot of, you know, there's a lot of evidence to use to substantiate for that, but it's just that not too many people are able to substantiate for that. Do I feel like Michael Saylor will be able to substantiate for that? Maybe, right? But he will have to, you know, shake off some shell shock before he then gets to the point where he's like, oh, okay, cool. The Bitcoin's value has nothing to do with this price. We should start there. Bitcoin's value has nothing to do with its price, has nothing to do with its exchange rate. Yep. It's decentralized, it's distributed, is stable monetary policy, sound money, hard money. And cool. What are the things you can do with Bitcoin that you cannot do with everything else? And for me, that is the type of conversation we should be having. So... yeah, all the things that will happen with Ethereum will play out. Some of them are already playing out because for some reason, the Ethereum people couldn't keep NFTs on their blockchain. And now we are out here paying, not maximum fees, but very high transaction fees. So yeah, we'll just see how that plays out.
Yeah, that'll be my last sort of question about Bitcoin in particular. Then I just want to open the floor to you to share anything that you'd like for the audience to hear. What are your feelings on ordinals? Obviously, this is an open source protocol. People can do what they want with it. We have this 4 megabytes of block mm-hmm. space that's available in every block, and it is what it is. It's a permissionless, decentralized, open source protocol. People can do what they want, but there is a reality to, fees being high. We want, in my humble opinion, I would like for people around the world to be able to have their UTXO, on the base chain, to have their little piece of the base chain. But it looks like I don't have enough of a technical mind to know what the workaround for that to get accomplished is, or whether it needs to be accomplished, or whether the Bitcoin can just be stored, I don't know, on a layer two or in some other place. I guess with my limited technical mind and the fact that I got into Bitcoin by being able to relatively cheaply make transactions on the Bitcoin blockchain, and I have my own UTXO on the main chain, I'd like that for other people as well. So how are you thinking about what's currently happening with ordinals and the difficulties it's making just in terms of what it costs to do a basic transaction on the base chain at this point?
I'll start by saying ordinals are fiat as fuck. Right. So it's really, one of those things that are a result of the fiat monetary system being what it is. At the end of the day, some people have more access to money than other people, right? Yep. For reasons that have nothing to do with them being productive or them knowing how to best use money. And ultimately, even without ordinals, I think Bitcoin would have experienced the same thing, just in a different fashion. Right. It's like Fortnite dances that people pay for, and then they're dancing in the game. It does nothing for the game, but people want to spend their money that way, and they can implicitly say I'm rich, right, just because they are doing it. And it's one of those things where you're like, okay, cool, people are going to want to show that they have money, so they're gonna recklessly spend their money. And even though NFTs have proven that, the whole thesis on NFTs is dead in the water, like the volumes are low, the marketplaces are not doing good business, and the celebrities are no longer talking about NFTs anymore, people are still taking the same NFT playbook and then bringing it to ordinals, right? So for me, that is stupidity, maybe even the definition of stupidity, insanity even, doing the same thing and expecting a different
over
result.
Over and over, different
right?
result.
So, yes, right? So NFTs over the 2020, 2021, even before that, because we had CryptoKitties in 2017, right? So CryptoKitties 2017 flopped. NFTs in 2020 flopped. Oh, what we're gonna do ordinals now? But because it's on Bitcoin, you are saying it will succeed. But the main thing with ordinals is NFTs via inscriptions. That is also gonna flop. And by the end of the day, since it's fiat as fuck, some people have money to put into this thing, whether or not it's profitable, whether or not it's productive, and it's all good as their money, right? So we'll just soldier through. The beauty of Bitcoin and most of the Bitcoin companies in the space is that they usually outlive everyone else, right? That whole, if you stand by the river long enough, you'll see the bodies of your enemies drift by. And yeah, so for us, it's just going to be that, right? And yeah, we'll see how other things play out of that. Yeah, we can have a discussion around the technical side of UTXOs and giving everyone ownership of their own UTXO. But there's other ways to achieve that, you know. Put a Bitcoin in the reserve of a country if you want, and then, you know, through some indirect nature, have all the people in that country hold Bitcoin. It's not, you know, self-custody, but a person can still self-custody their Bitcoin if they want. So yeah, let's just use our imaginations and come up with not yet tried or ways to actually give people access to Bitcoin, right? And yeah, that being said, I would like to mention that we are hosting Adopting Bitcoin Cape Town. So if anyone wants to come through, feel free to come through. We're going to be doing this January 26th and 27th. So yeah, it's going to be a fun time. We're going to have a lot of amazing speakers highlighting some of the most interesting Bitcoin companies and parallel institutions in South Africa and the rest of the world.
Yeah, to if anybody is thinking about that, if anyone's listening and thinking about going but they're on the fence, I'm going to highly recommend it. I actually went to my first Adopting Bitcoin when I interviewed Kamal, who was one of the organizers for Adopting Bitcoin. He sort of gave the same pitch at the end of my interview with him. I had just bought my ticket for the African Bitcoin Conference in Ghana, and just based on Kamal's energy, his vibe, all that stuff, I just decided, all right, I'm going to work some extra jobs and make this happen. I am bummed to say that I cannot make it back to Africa next month, but I'm planning, and I've been speaking with some people to actually spend some time in different parts of the continent next year. So hopefully, if not, you know, I can't make it this year, but hopefully if it happens again in Cape Town next year, I will be there. Super excited that you're doing it down there. I love what's going on. If people aren't familiar with Bitcoin Akasi, I think that they'll be taking a trip out to Mazel Bay to visit Bitcoin Akasi. Akasi is slang there for township. Mm-hmm. It's one of the circular economies, one of the, in my opinion, one of the most impressive ones. Yeah, I won't go too far down that rabbit hole, but I think KG, you're working with Herman from Bitcoin Akasi on organizing Adopting Bitcoin, if I'm not incorrect. Yeah.
Yes, we're working with him and a few other people as well. Nice. So it's going to be a very fun affair.
Awesome. Yeah. So all of the stuff you said today, I love it. I'm going to be on a high for a while just thinking about all this and the beautiful ways you phrase things and explain them and the analogies you use and everything. Truly amazing. And thank you for taking the time to share your mind and your time with us. Anything you'd like to share with the audience? Any last thoughts or, you know, just any ideas you want to put out there?
I can't, you know, actually. So, no, okay. But thank you very much for having me.
My pleasure. Yeah. Where to find you online, any other information you'd like to share, you know, how to check out Machankoro, all this kind of stuff, anything the audience should know?
Oh, yeah. You can pretty much find most of the information you need from the Machankoro website, which is 833.mobi. So that's 833.mobi. That's 3 threes. And yeah, that's where you're going to find most of the information. Our Twitter, our Nostra, and everything else will be there.
Cool. Awesome. And I will leave KG's Twitter handle, everything else that I have for contacting him, as well as that information he just shared in the show notes. Super, super happy that I got the chance to meet you in Ghana. Thank you very much for doing this. As I said to you when I invited you to do this, I just, you know, given that this platform is not that big and you've been on much bigger ones, I very much appreciate you taking the time to do this. I'm a tremendous fan of what you're doing, getting to know you a little bit more, understanding sort of the way, you know, what you do is creatively infused is just mind blowing to me. I find this stuff fascinating. And again, I think the African Bitcoiner community made the right decision in choosing you as the number one person this year. Not that the number matters or whatever, that's the most important thing in the world, but I do think it's important that people who are maybe unaware of what you're doing become a bit more aware of it. And hopefully this does that for people. So yeah, please check out what KG's doing. And again, thank you for doing this. We'll talk soon.
Thank you very much, man. And yeah, keep doing what you're doing as well with the podcast. Yeah, I hope to see very big things coming out of this.
Will do. Will do. Will do my best. Much appreciated. All right, everybody. We'll talk soon.